Hi, this is Steve Carroll. Welcome to another episode of Careers Behind the Code, this time with Scott Hunter, the Director of PM for the .NET team. Hello, and welcome back after quite a ways away to Careers Behind the Code. This is our show where we talk about people's careers and how to build them. My name is Steve Carroll. I'm the Director of Development for the .NET team at Microsoft, and I'm really excited because today we have with us Scott Hunter. Scott, do you want to introduce yourself for the folks at home?
Sure. For folks that don't know me, my name is Scott Hunter, and I'm the Director of Program Management at Microsoft on the .NET platform. A little history for me. I've been at Microsoft for 13 years now. I joined Microsoft in 2007. I joined the ASP.NET team. And I then moved around Microsoft a little bit because what happened was when Scott Guthrie, our EVP, Executive Vice President, moved to Azure, he took all the web parts of developer division with him to Azure. And so I got to go spend a couple of years in the Azure org, still building ASP.NET, but also building a couple of services, the SDK for Azure, and so on. And then in 2016, I had a chance to move back to developer division, and we put all of .NET back together into a single organization again. And that's kind of how Steve and I got together.
Yeah, that's right. So like I've only been in .NET for about 2 years at this point. But yeah, Scott's history goes back much further with it. I want to focus on your current role right now. So like, let's say what the director for PM for the .NET team does. Like what's day to day like?
Well, I'll give you a joke. I've been a program manager at Microsoft for 13 years now. I still can't tell you what a program manager is, even though I do the role. In my current role, day to day is primarily doing a bunch of what we call director reviews. So obviously .NET is a big piece of technology. We've got the desktop stacks like WinForms and WPF. We have the web stacks with ASP.NET. We have ML.NET for AI. We have the Visual Studio tooling, and we have just fundamentals and stuff like that. So a good chunk of my days is spent doing various reviews with each of those teams. A part of the PM job, though, is not only do we build the technology, parts of my team focus on doing the customer development, going out and reaching out to the real humans that are behind the keyboards using the product and seeing what they need for their jobs and helping us drive .NET in that direction. Part of my job also is to work with the marketing team to make sure that we're actually promoting .NET the best way to all of our developers. And you might see that through some virtual conferences like .NET Conf. We have one of those coming up in November for the next release. We also have various big events like Build and Ignite. And so looking at the product, talking to customers, marketing the product, and then also watching the technology space. I mean, one of the reasons I'm still in .NET after 13 years is the problems we're solving today are very different than the problems we tried to solve in 2007. So it makes the job always fresh.
Got it. And so that's sort of like the technical strategy part where you're also keeping a tight understanding of what's going on technically across the entire industry in order to like make intelligent decisions. Is that
right? Yeah. I mean, like for example, over that 13 years, REST APIs became a very important thing. And so we built the REST capabilities into ASP.NET when that happened. Cross-platform became a big thing, especially for web-style applications. And so we had to go pivot .NET to run on Linux and Mac so we could solve that. And so lots of those types of things of watching the technology trends and making sure that when they happen, we are waiting for it to happen, not, oh, crap. let's try to go catch up.
Exactly. And I think another, just to, again, really zoom in on this sort of concept of what a director is, because that word is so different across different companies is that you're also like a multi-level manager, right? Like you're manager of managers. Is that the right way to?
Manager of managers. Yes. So yeah. I think of director roles in, it's sometimes it's the scope of the team that you're on. It's the scope of the product that you're on. That determines whether you have a director role. I mean, in the case of like .NET, there are various directors that report into .NET because .NET is a very large business. We have over 5 million customers, and the product you know, brings a lot of revenue into developer division via Visual Studio. So in some ways, it's scope of team, scope of project, which determines, you know, those kinds of roles. But as you said, Steve, as well, I have a whole pile of managers that report to me, and they have managers that report to them. So it is the size and complexity of the organization.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a great point. Let's start transitioning into like, so how did you get to where you are today? So like you gave a broad overview of sort of like you came in working and then sort of moved to Azure, came back, did everything from small services to back to this large platform thing. But let's walk through some of those transitions. So like what were you doing before you became the director for .NET, and how did that transition go?
Yeah, there's lots of transitions actually, Steve. So before director of .NET, I was over in a different part of Microsoft. I was in the Azure platform app platform team at the time. And for folks that don't know what that is, that team, when I was in it, we built the Azure portal, we built Azure App Service, we built some of the Azure Media streaming capabilities, we built the Azure SDKs. And so I was in this team, and I personally ran the SDKs, Azure API Management, Azure Redis Cache, ASP.NET, and the web tools for Visual Studio. Even though we were in a different org, a lot of our bits still shipped as part of the developer division. So I was still always close to developer division. But that role was a much different role because I had a lot of products, and they were a lot of different products. Our group's goal was to get the entire org to a certain revenue target inside of Microsoft. And that's why you see lots of services and stuff there, as we were building services to, you know, to go make revenue. But that job,
is it reasonable to say that it was like a difference between having a lot of products versus having a lot of verticals within one product? Is that the right way to think about it?
Great way to think about it. I having a bunch of verticals in a product is simpler to me because they're at least in the same scope. If you look at Azure API Management and Azure Redis Cache, there is no overlap. There is no, these were distinct things. And I, you know, one of the things that I used to struggle with back in those days was, I think the human brain can only context switch X number of times per day. So it would be very difficult for me when I was doing that role. I would have to set days aside for certain products because I couldn't do API Management, Redis Cache, Azure SDK, and ASP.NET in the same day. I might be able to do two in one day, but by the third one, my mind just turned to mush. And I remember sometimes the team would come in and want to do some review, and I'm like, I'm still thinking about Redis Cache right now. I can't make that context switch. And so it was one of the nice things about moving to developer division, where I moved back into more of a singular product, .NET. As you said, Steve, .NET has very, very various verticals inside of it. You know, the desktop stacks, the mobile stacks, the web stacks, but they're all still all related to the same tech. And so I find the new role to be a little bit easier when it comes to context switching than the old role.
Got it. So like, but was that like an intentional career choice that you made? Was that the result of some other, like, one of the common things that goes through these episodes is people are like, well, there was this reorg, and or was this something that you sought out yourself?
Yeah, it was interesting. So I will throw some interesting context in the conversation. So the reality is, while I was in Azure, we still shipped a lot of our bits. ASP.NET, the web tools, they were all part of Visual Studio and the .NET team. And so even though I was in a completely different organization, I still worked very closely with developer division during all of that era, to the point that many times developer division asked, well, why is Scott's team not in developer division? And the historical reality was the people that I was working for in Azure, they were all part of the initial creation of ASP.NET and the web tools and IIS. And so they didn't want us to leave either because they felt they were part of those products for their entire history.
DNA.
And so I was kind of in no person land, where I belonged in another team, but my current team didn't want me to go. And so comically enough, as you said, it wasn't a reorg, my boss retired. And when my boss retired, James Phillips came in to run that older org. And that was a chance where James didn't have that history that my previous bosses had. And so as soon as James came in, I actually, it's actually a funny story. Alon Lipton, one of the engineers on our team, will remember this. He stops at my office and he goes, "Hey, can we do a 101? And I'm like, "Yeah, well, let's do it on the way to Building 18. And he's like, "We're walking to Building 18. He goes, why are we going to Building 18? I'm like, "I'm just
where the .NET team is now.
Right? Is now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was then too. And I'm like, "Well, I'm going to go talk to Julia Lucen, and I'm going to propose that we move our team over to developer division." And so I remember walking over there and sitting down with Julia. And for folks that don't know, Julia Lucen is the CVP that runs developer division.
Yeah, she's our fearless leader. Yeah,
she's our fearless leader. And so she, John Montgomery, who was the PM leader at that time in developer division, we started having that conversation about how we could move my team in. And so it was not a reorg necessarily, Steve, but it was a leadership change that enabled those forces that prevented us moving all the tech together. That broke down. And when that did, we were able to move the team.
So you basically were able to identify a place where there was sort of like suboptimal organizational dynamics, and therefore you kind of took some initiative to find the right home for the place, and then made some deals in order to get it so that your role was a little bit. And at the same point, it sounds like you solved some organizational dynamics problems, as well as you were able to kind of clear up some of those context switching problems that you were having. Like, you didn't only just like get the thing homed in the place where it belonged, but you also were able to construct a role that you felt you could be higher leverage in. Is that a good way of putting it?
I think that's a great way of thinking about that. And there's some interesting dynamics from that. So this is a little bit before your time, Steve, but one of the fondest things as a manager that I remember career-wise, when that transition happens, we transitioned in, I think it was early 2016 is when our teams moved. And then, you know, for my career, one of the biggest challenges is I had been the ASP.NET person from 2007 to 2016. okay. And when I moved, you know, into the .NET team, the most important thing for me was I didn't want to be known as the ASP.NET person that's driving .NET. So what I did is I actually, at the time, .NET was in two buildings. It was in building 25 and it was building 18. And so I purposely put myself in building 25 and I put the ASP.NET team in building 18.
To create physical space.
To create a physical separation between me and that team. As a manager, I had to, in many ways, try not to be the ASP.NET person. So when it came to like conferences and stuff like that, I didn't speak on ASP.NET. I spoke on .NET. And that was part of I wanted to make sure the .NET team didn't see that the ASP.NET team was trying to run .NET, that the .NET team was trying to run .NET.
Got it. So like basically this is a case where in order to make a successful transition across that career boundary, you had to really change that identity piece to help the team understand that you weren't the outside interloper coming in to fix the bad team.
Exactly.
That you were actually going to be willing to put yourself in there. I'm laughing at this as I'm sitting in my upstairs room and you're laughing in your room. And I'm trying to think in my head, like, what's the 2020 after times version of this? Scott, you have to go like buy a house next to a different employee than the one that you're currently near. So we can continue to use this technique.
I don't know what you do today. But it's funny that separation. I know many people inside of Microsoft, other peers that have had their roles changed, and I've actually had one-on-ones with them and talked to them about the same thing. It's like you have to hide away from some of the places you were before to make sure that the team doesn't think you're biased the wrong way and you're only coming from a a single, a vertical versus the entire thing. And so I've seen it happen to various people, in their careers at Microsoft, the same kind of thing. And and it's tough. It was really tough to, in many ways, it's like I had to give up my baby to get a bigger baby. So
one of the themes that tends to run through these episodes that, again, is something I find really interesting is this idea that, like, in some ways, making that clean pivot, right? It's like in some ways easier, right? Like a lot of people think, oh, if I transition from this role to this like bigger role that includes my old role, well, that's easy because I already know how to do this. But actually in that situation, you have to really focus on helping first your own brain from doing your old job, as well as helping to create this gap, as opposed to my last transition, which was from C++ over into .NET. Like, they're not warring camps or anything, but those are just separate things, right? Yeah. Internally, they have separate cultures, they're separate teams. And so me coming in there, I didn't have that problem because I could just kind of focus on creating a .NET thing, and I wasn't going to be being the C++ guy doesn't help you with that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll throw more curves at you. I mean, it was even more challenging than that because the ASP.NET team and the .NET team had various challenges over the years. We were in a different org with very different rules than .NET and developer division.
Yeah.
And sometimes there was animosity between the teams. I mean, not bad animosity, but in some ways, we didn't have any rules over in our org. And developer division had a bunch of rules and in some ways implied because different businesses. I'm in the Azure space and we're focusing on doing the right thing for Azure. Developer division, right, is at that time was working on a bunch of Windows stuff. In many, many ways, the web stuff looked cooler, I think, in some ways. That was another challenge too, was to integrate the ASP.NET team back into .NET and erase all of that history that was there. And I think for the most part we've been successful. I don't think you've been here a couple of years now. I don't think you've heard the old ASP.NET team, or I think we've got a successful cohesive team that acts as a single team, not as verticals that.
Yeah. I think there's something to what you're saying in terms of like, that teams tend to think that culture follows their culture. I don't think teams appreciate how much the culture derives from the business goal. And so you'll have two teams like, well, I type code and you type code and they kind of ship in the same box. So like, why aren't we aligned? Right. Whereas in reality, if you're trying to do something at the web cadence versus you're trying not to break legacy customers, those drive your culture way more and actually
That is actually one of the culture problems that we had back then was we were shipping ASP.NET about every 3 or 4 months. And at that point in time, .NET was shipping every 3 years. The compatibility challenges of .NET limited what the team could do as well. And so, we had taken all of ASP.NET, what we called out of band, which means it was no longer in the .NET framework. We were shipping stuff outside of the .NET framework. And because of that, we could, have different rules. We could ship faster. We could make breaking changes. We could do stuff that the .NET team could not do. A lot of that thinking is one of the things that Steve and I work on is .NET Core. And that is, a bunch of thinking that we did as a group to go and solve those problems for the larger .NET team. So it had better abilities to stay up to date, ship faster, react better to current situations.
Okay, so this is great. So in this transition, there were a lot of like different things that you had to do in order to become successful and to continue to grow successful career as that sort of higher level leader across these pieces. I'm curious, like, do you feel like you had to like work all this out for yourself, or did you have this coming from a manager who like, where did you get the, how do I learn to do these things?
Yeah, so in my case, I have a little bit of history there. So if I go further back in my career, I worked, the first part of my career was at a company called Mustang Software.
Okay.
This is going to seem like crazy old. We built pre-internet technology using modems. You know, we were doing all that kind of stuff. That was a great company. I was there for, just trying to think, I think 13 years. We sold that company in 2001. And we were a public company. We were traded on NASDAQ. And when we sold the company, this is going to sound crazy. We made some investors very rich. Our company started off great, and it had a moment in the middle when the internet happened. If you're building non-internet tech and the internet happens, there's an upheaval that occurs, and we had to reinvent the company. When we were in the bad part of that reimagining our company, we took some money to help us survive long enough to reimagine the company, and we did successfully reimagine the company, and it sold for a lot of money, and those people that helped us, well, they were buying shares at like $1. And they got to sell those shares at $35, and they had millions of those shares. Wow. So they did really well. And so after we had sold Mustang, they asked us to go look at some of the other companies they invested in. We did a web boutique. That's a company that builds websites for companies. And we did it very – we show up. We just kind of look and watch, and we go back and tell the investors – should they keep investing? And if they're going to keep investing, are there changes they should ask the company to make to be successful? So we went and did this web boutique. We were only there for a few months, and the investors came back to us, and they had this company called Starbase in Southern California that they wanted us to go look at. And Starbase was interesting to us because we'd always worked on a single company with like a single product line. And Starbase was basically a company that had bought three other companies. So in many ways, it parallels
I see
some of what happened in .NET, where I had to go take, in Starbase, I had to go take all these other products and make them all work together.
I see. So you'd basically gotten some practice earlier in your career at integration.
I had practiced this, yes. So I would say that I didn't have any career advice from my managers when I took the dev job. It was more of, I was using experience I had learned previously in my career. Again, I will tell you, there is a, there is one thing that I did learn from John Montgomery that I think it's one of the best lessons I've ever learned in my career. And that was, don't surround yourself with people like yourself.
Mm.
When I was in ASP.NET, especially, all the people around me we were all the same mindset, the same thinking, and maybe that was okay in that product because it's one product.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look, in 2016 and beyond, if you look at my leadership team today compared to my leadership team before, you'll find they're very different people, and it comes down to having a diversity of opinions.
Yeah,
it's so, so important. I want people that actually will challenge me and say, that's wrong, or you're making the wrong decision. I don't want a bunch of people around me that are just going to say, sure, that's yes. I don't want
yes,
a bunch
sir.
Of yes people. I want a bunch of people that will challenge me every day. So that was probably the big career advice that I got from John Montgomery. Was I was hiring when we had open spots, and he goes, everybody you're hiring,
cloning machine,
feels like it's the same mold. He goes, try hiring some completely different people. If I look at my team today, I think my team is much healthier today because of some of those decisions.
How do you think that most like shows up? Is it like making better decisions? Is it more just like you get like a larger number of decisions that are like a larger solution space? Like how does that actually in practice turn out to matter?
I think it's making better decisions. And it's really, I think, hearing diverse opinions.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest thing for me, if everybody said, go build AOT, go build AOT, go build AOT, that's great.
Ahead of time AOT. Compilation for those following along at home. Yes.
Any random thing. I could have chosen anything. But having a diverse team, diversity means many things. This is just having diverse opinions is what I'm really asking for. And so if one part of the team wants to do this and the other part of the team says we should do this and we find a compromise in the middle, well, we've just knocked out two things in a better way. And so, you know, it's hard to quantify that. But I just know that the team makes better decisions today than it did when it was more of us all being the same person.
Got it. All right. What are any other transitions you want to talk about? What any other job A to job B, how you managed to like get to this point where you're doing this sort of manager role? Like, what do you think the formative decisions were? Were there a lot of them? Was it, or do you feel like overall you've mostly followed along a path, or have you made any like really hard, I need to go left instead of right decisions across your career?
The hardest left or right decision was the developer division. And I left out part of that as well. There was a different piece of that. You know, when I moved into developer division in 2016, there was more to that. There was my new boss, James Phillips, wanted me to go in a different direction, meaning he wanted me to work on some different products in his organization. And so I had to make the decision, do I go work on the different product or do I stay with .NET? And so that's probably the hardest one of those type deflection points, which also led to me going over to Julia and asking to move the team, and maybe there might be some career advice there is the thing I was asked to go work on. Hey, it's tech that's in Microsoft today. It's successful. It's pretty good. But my heart was in .NET and we were in the middle of this journey of moving .NET to .NET Core and solving a bunch of the historical .NET problems. And, you know, I went where my heart was.
Got it.
You know, I could have done the other thing. And I'm sure we would have been successful. It would have been great. But I'm glad I made that decision to go where, you know, I at that point in time, you know, all the people in ASP.NET, I hired most of the ones on my team at that point. It felt like I was going to have to go leave the people that I hired and leave technology that was on a journey that was not done. And I think that was, you know, an important one. You see that in Microsoft and other places. I mean, like Steve Ballmer, my favorite example of something very similar to this was, you know, years ago, how long has Satya been our CEO now?
We're all about to get fired. 6 years, is it? Five?
6 years, something like that. I think six. But I remember Steve mentioning that he thought that Microsoft needed to go through a transition, and he thought that transition would be longer than he wanted his career, you know, to be at Microsoft. He was like, I don't want to go through a rebuild because I don't know how long that rebuild is going to take. And that was what, you know, led to Steve kind of stepping down and making that room for Satya. And I think that's the same kind of thing. It's I was already in that journey of doing a transformation and I didn't want to leave till it was finished. While Steve left knowing that we needed to have a cultural revolution at Microsoft, that cultural revolution, meaning that Windows was not the center of the universe.
Yeah.
So I do see parallels to what I did in other people, you know, as I look at the.
So you really felt like you wanted to take that journey with the people that you had, that you'd gone on. And so that really helped you kind of just like align your passion to what you were doing.
Yeah.
Got it. How did you end up here in the first place? Like what led your path to Microsoft?
So, you know, I mentioned we did those, you know, I did the startup. And then we did what we called turnaround companies. That's where you go and investors put you into a broken thing and you help fix that thing. That was a funny one. The Starbase company is interesting because Starbase was bought by Borland. And during that purchase, a lot of the folks that are on the .NET team today were at Borland before. But what really led, you know, that Mustang to Starbase journey was interesting because we went from a 150 person company to a 400 person company. And it was a very different kind of thing. As I mentioned before, it was not a single product. It was a bunch of products. We had to integrate them. After we had done the turnarounds, I applied to Microsoft. And in my mind, what I was thinking was, I was just curious, did the same things I had learned at Mustang and Starbase, would they apply to Microsoft? And I learned some interesting things about that. When I joined Microsoft, You know, people don't realize this, but most of our hires are actually out of college. I was what's called an industry hire, and we don't do lots of industry hires, or at least the majority of our people are from college. And that's because Microsoft has a weird culture. I mean, all big companies are going to have a culture. And, you know, if you come from a place, like I came from a place where we were part of the leadership team, and so we made all the decisions. And so to come and join Microsoft, where suddenly I've got four levels of bosses above me that are trying to make as well. You know, it was actually, I was curious if I could actually fit into that mindset. I'll say one more anecdote about that too, which is when we sold Mustang in 2001, the last thing I did is I took my lead engineer. So by the way, I was an engineering manager then.
Okay.
So I've done the engineering manager role and I've done the PM role. And my thank you to my lead engineers was I took them all to Disney World in Orlando, and it just happened to be that the Microsoft Professional Developer Conference was running while we were in Orlando. And so we got to go watch Scott Guthrie introduce ASP.NET on stage for the first time at PDC, which was the Professional Developer Conference. And that's what seeded my thinking in .NET and Microsoft. I still went and did the Starbase thing after that, but that stuff never got out of my head from that 2001 PDC. And so once we had sold Starbase to Borland, I started looking at Microsoft as a place to come.
So funny. I wonder how often that happens where like the person who eventually ends up taking the thing, the next level, is sitting in the audience going, this seems like interesting. What managing, like when did you make the transition from engineering to PM? Was that like, I want to be more businessy? Like what was that? What drove that? How did you make that decision? That it's like one of the most common things that faces people. Like,
yeah.
Discipline.
That was driven because of, when I was at Mustang, Mustang's a funny one too. I joined Mustang. It was my first job out of college. And it's funny because this is another career advice that I would tell everybody is, when I first went to college to do computer science, I'm like, hey, you know what? This is a great career. I was a nervous, shy guy. I was afraid to talk in front of a bunch of people or stuff like that. And I'm like, hey, if I do computers, I don't have to talk to a bunch of people. And I learned that is not the case. So I get to Mustang, and we're a startup. When I joined Mustang, I was the fourth employee, and which meant that we did all the jobs. And so not only did I write code, but I also had to answer the phone and do support calls. And I was terrible. And of course, we just worked in a warehouse kind of environment. So the other three employees could hear my calls. And I remember the CEO of the company comes and sits with me, Scott, we have to get this fixed. We need to get you to some, you need to take some training on how to communicate. So I went through that. That was interesting. And so I learned that, I never would have thought that, you know, a big chunk of your career is actually how well you can communicate.
Yeah.
And so I would always tell people focus on communication skills, no matter if you're an engineer or a program manager or whatnot.
Experience.
Those skills will always matter to you. At Mustang, I became a manager at Mustang. So I came to Microsoft with previous manager experience. But at Mustang, because I was on the executive board, I was involved in marketing. I was involved in product. Nice. I was involved in all the things that the program manager role at Microsoft kind of does.
Nice.
And so when it came to me, when I was looking at Microsoft, I'm like, I didn't know, once again, I'm outside of Microsoft at the time. So I didn't know if I joined as an engineer, would I have the opportunity to do those things? And after doing the, you know, all the working with marketing, working on branding, working on how do you sell it at the startups, when I came to Microsoft, I wanted something that kind of mapped to that. And it felt to me that the program manager role mapped better to that than the engineering role did. But that was the first time in my career. So I was an engineer through all the startups, all the way to joining Microsoft in 07. And then I switched because I wanted to drive the business part of it just as much as I wanted to drive the technical parts of it.
Got it. Yeah, it seems like it. So it's interesting. Like, you basically got a chance to practice all the skills that you would kind of get to. I don't. It wasn't practice. You were doing it, of course, but like, learn on the job.
It practiced.
But because you were in a startup kind of place, you got to do literally everything, which allowed you both to kind of see which ones were the best match for you, and then you were able to kind of rely on those experiences, almost like rotating around those roles in order to decide what the one that ended up matching you the most is. Interesting.
And at the startups I went through, you definitely have gone through this, Steve. I know you have to have. I went through at Mustang. I was one of the primary coders.
Yeah.
And then I became a manager, and I still wanted to be the primary coder. And so I did the best I could to juggle both of those things. By the time we got to like Starbase and stuff like that, I had to give up. I had to be a manager, not a coder manager.
Yeah.
Which I know that, a lot of engineers in our org have gone through those same models of, there's some point in your career, you have to make that inflection deciding, do you want to keep coding? Do you want to manage people? But it was funny. I joined Microsoft in 07 and I was an IC. So I also got to be an IC again for a while, but I was only an IC for like 8 months. And my boss at the time was Simon Calvert. And he goes, mm-hmm. Scott, he was promoted to be into a new role where he was supposed to have managers report to him. And so he's like, Scott, I need you to be a manager. And I'm like, well, I've done that before. And so I was only an IC at Microsoft for probably 7 or 8 months before I flipped back into being a manager.
Got it. Yeah. I think in my own personal case, like I like the thing you're talking about where it's like, you're the proto manager. You just become a manager and you have to learn how to like stop being just the best coder on the team. Yeah, for me, I think actually there was a hole in PM for a while that I actually basically had to go off and do that. And so that didn't. So then that pulled me away from coding enough that it was a lot to allow me to make that transition. It's funny how everybody needs some sort of like impetus to get away from being the best coder into being just somebody who focuses and actually cares about managing instead. Cool. All right. So we got pretty far back in the old chronology. So how did you get into computers, Scott? How did you?
So I got into computers. This will date me a little bit. My dad, 1 year, brought home a Commodore PET. That was a personal computer. Then it was in the era of Apple II. You either had an Apple II or you had a Commodore PET or a TRS-80. And my dad brings a computer home. And it's in their bedroom. I think it lasted in their bedroom for a week. I moved to my bedroom. And what I did is, this is the old way you learned how to code, is you went to the bookstore and you bought these books with 101 games in them. Yep. And you hand typed the basic into the computer. Mm-hmm. And then you learned a program when you screwed up typing it in and it didn't run.
Yeah. You had to figure out
how to make it run.
Yeah.
But that literally was my entry to computers was, basically my dad brings a personal computer home for himself. And, within just a week or two, it moves to my room cause I'm on it 24/7. And then I learned to program by typing in, code from books.
Right. Yeah. For me, same PC, but just substitute in the PC Junior, but it's definitely typing in from a book. You did something with BBS doors then a little later in the, did I hear that right?
Yeah, BBSs. So bulletin board systems. And that was the predecessor to what we would call, the social networking stuff on the internet today. Yeah. In that case, you had a modem, which is a device that you plug your phone line into to enable you to call into some other computer. And that was actually how I transitioned into, my ties to .NET are really weird. So what I did is I when I had my computer at this point, I was on a PC. I moved to a PC at this point and I ran my own bulletin board system. So at night when my parents went to bed, I unplugged all the phones. And then if you called, so you weren't allowed to call my modem until 10 o'clock at night. And after 10 o'clock at night, everything went to my computer. And so then you want to customize this BBS. And so I decide I want to customize the BBS. And so I reached out to the author of this bulletin board system. It was called Colossus. And the author of it was a guy, his name was Dan Plunkett. He was the author. I reached out to him on his bulletin board because he writes bulletin board software. And I was able to get the source code for Colossus. And the source code for Colossus, Triple Pascal.
Oh, yes!
So here's how weird this is then I get one of my friends that I've met online. This is Jim Hare. He and I find each other through a mutual friend. And he wants to work on the BBS as well. Well, Jim ends up being the CEO of Mustang Software. and so I'm still in college, and Jim's like, you know, we worked on Colossus for a bit, and Jim's like, I want to build my own. And so he goes and starts Mustang Software. They consult during the day to raise the money, and they work on the BBS at night, and they start building what was called Wildcat BBS.
Yeah, sure. I'm a little younger than you, and so like these were like the things the older kids who like parents would let them use the phone line were doing, and I was the guy calling in after 10. That was me.
Here's where this story gets really crazy. So I'm in my at the end of my first year of college at the University of Arkansas in Arkansas, and my mom says you have to get a job. And so, and at the time, my mom was actually a recruiter for businesses. And so she's like, I got you the perfect job. You're going to drive a forklift at Crate and Barrel. Perfect. And I'm like, no, I am not going to do that. So I call Jim up and I'm like, do you have room for an employee? And literally within 2 weeks, I picked up all my stuff. I drove to California and I joined Mustang Software. Never took that job. My mom wanted me to go. My only requirement was that I had to finish college, which I did in California. That was the rule my mom gave me. But when we first started Mustang, all the tech was written in Turbo Pascal, which became Borland Pascal.
Yeah.
And we were one of the largest ISVs, independent software vendors, that was building on top of Turbo Pascal. And so we get an invitation to come up once a year to Borland, to hang out in Anders Hausberg house. And for people that don't know, Anders Hausberg is like the inventor of C Sharp. He left Borland, went to Microsoft, and in many ways is a huge part of the early .NET. But I used to go up once a year to Anders' home, drink beer, while they would show us the next version of Borland Pascal. And so it's so weird that I met Anders when Anders was not at Microsoft.
Yeah.
And later joined the same team that Anders was a part of. And then also weird that I took my whole engineering team to the PDC in 2001, saw Scott Guthrie, later came to work at Microsoft working for Scott Guthrie.
Yeah.
I cannot think of how all these things crisscrossed, and I landed, you know, in the same org as Scott Guthrie and Anders Hausberg, people I had both met in other forms before, you know, joining Microsoft.
Yeah. So I'll say to anybody watching this that the double crazy thing about this is if you go back and watch the episode we shot with Miguel de Casa, like, again, all of these sort of serendipitous things that sort of start off with nerds on the proto internet. You know, IRC in his case and BBSs in yours are that's actually also how his path kind of led circuitously to Microsoft. So like I definitely think for the if perhaps there are, you know, aspiring engineers who are still trying to decide if this computer thing is for them. Find your tribe or something.
I'll throw one more fun tidbit out as well. I failed my first Microsoft interview.
Did you?
So the first time I interviewed at Microsoft, because I'd worked at Starbase, I always, when I decided to, I wanted to go work for Microsoft, I wanted to work for either the C# team or the ASP.NET team. Cause those are the two pieces of technology in .NET that I had used in my career after we sold the startup. But because Starbase built kind of a product very similar to, Team Foundation Server, I thought I was applying for, I'd applied for a .NET job. But I show up and I'm interviewing with the TFS team.
Team Foundation Server.
Team Foundation Server. And that interview did not go well. I'm like, why are you asking me all these source control questions? I had no desire to work on TFS. And so that interview did not go well. That was one, you know, for people that know Microsoft interview lore of the day, if you got sent home before after lunch, you weren't going to make it.
Yeah.
And then I got a chance to apply again about 2 years later. And this time I told the recruiter, do not fly me up to Redmond unless I'm going to talk to the .NET team. And nice. That way, that interview went much better because it was the actual team that I, you know, I wanted to work for.
Yeah, there's a good lesson in being persistent, but also knowing what you want, right? In that. So my last questions are always, what's your best career advice you ever gotten? I think you actually answered that one because you talked about the early in your career, someone telling you to focus on communication. Did you ever get any bad career advice? Things you feel like that common wisdom that you just plain old disagree with, or somebody gave you bad advice?
The worst career advice was actually recent in the last couple of years. And it was, in many cases, we sometimes don't give up on something fast enough. And this was a case where something was wrong and we could have made a snap decision to move. And instead we did not make a snap decision and we waited too long. And it was not good for people and not good for team. And so that was the worst advice was, if you really feel something is wrong, don't just wait 6 more months or 12 more months. If all your sensors are going off saying this is not right, this is not good.
Yeah, listen.
Listen. And that was, I actually wrote that in my review that year. I'm like, man, my biggest mistake this year was I should have made a decision way faster than I did.
Yeah. Got it. Great. All right, Scott, thank you so much for your time. And that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of Careers Behind the Code. I hope you learned something from this and catch you next time.